Hi, everybody. My name's Ed Newton, and I'm an alcoholic. By the grace of God, the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous sponsorship, I have not found it necessary to take a drink or a mood-altering chemical since January 5th of 1971, and for that I'm extremely grateful. So it's good to be here. I want to thank all the men whose first initial is M. You guys got more marks and mics and on your committee than I've ever seen before. I just thank all men who are named M. Start with M. But I want to thank the marks and the mics who helped me to get here and invited me. And Sue, wonderful job. I've never been treated better anywhere I've ever been. Doug, I want to thank you. Doug had to make a trial run to pick me up. My ticket said I was supposed to be here Thursday, but I read it as Friday, and I won. And so he was kind enough to come and get me again Friday. And I appreciate it, and I appreciate his lovely wife, Barb, and the kindness that they have shown me. You know, you get host wherever you go, and it's always a wonderful experience. And I have a number of people here tonight who have hosted me and who've come to say hi to me, and I thank you for that because I love you. I love you with all my heart. You took a part of your life and you devoted it just so I'd be comfortable, just so I have what I need. That's why it's very easy for me to tell you as members of Alcoholics Anonymous that I love you. It isn't about a popularity contest and it isn't about what you think about me. It's what I think about you and that I love you with all my heart. And a while back, I got permission to tell this story. I came into Kansas City and my host picked me up. He's hiding already. I see him. And I got out of the plane, and I come out, and there's this 1952-something rattling away and smoke pouring out the hood. I said, here we are. I said, oh, good. And we got the stuff in the car, and I said, I don't mean to interrupt you, but you think, how far is the hotel from here? He said, 23 miles. And I thought, we ain't going to make it, bud. You need to park this bad boy is what you need to do. So he argued with me for a minute, and then he parked it. And we went out, we opened up the hood, and there were no fan belts on it anyway. So I said, I think it might be an idea if I just go ahead to the hotel. What do you think? So I got a cab, went to the hotel, and he got it all fixed. He came, picked me up later. And, we got in his car, man, it was hot. I said, yeah, can you turn on the air? He said, you can roll down the window. Here's the vice grips. No, in fact, I didn't have a vice grips that first night. He had to get me one. So I had to kind of use his air, you know? But you see, what I loved about that is Paul brought his very best to share with me. I would have had too big ego to do that. I would have said, no, I can't. Because I would have been worried. And what he did is he set an example that's been set here this weekend. Is we offer you everything we got for your use. We just want to love you. We want to take care of you. It's one of the best examples I've had of Alcoholics Anonymous in a long, long time. And I thank you for that, and I thank everybody who's been so kind to me this weekend. I was doing pretty well right up until about 2 hours ago. Somebody said it. Same two questions. Somebody 5'6". First question is, how tall are you? 6'10". The next question is, how do you play basketball? No, and I say, how tall are you? And they say, 5'6". I say, do you play miniature golf? Seems fair to me, by golly. But I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love being sober, and I love God, and I don't apologize for any of the three anymore. There was a long time in AA when I had to call God a lot of different names, because I felt I might offend you, and if I told you I really loved you, then that might be trouble. I'm just not afraid of any of it anymore. I just love you, and I love God, and I love being sober. I don't know if anybody's got a better life than I do. I really don't, and I say that humbly, not braggadocio, believe me. But I don't know if anybody has got a better life than I do, and I just really, you know, when they read those promises tonight, tears come to my eyes one more time, because I can testify to you that they are indeed true. That they're more than just words. They're more than just a nice saying to keep you coming back if you're new. If you keep doing this deal, you're going to comprehend the word serenity and you are going to know peace. I promise you. With all my heart, I promise you. I got no reason to lie to you. Nothing in it for me. I come from a very elite group of people called white trash, and we worked hard to uphold our image. There wasn't a lot of question about it, actually, and I didn't like that. My earliest memories in life was I didn't like me, and I didn't like you, and I didn't like the way I felt. Well, that's not quite true. I was always real sensitive. My heart would break easily. Really would. I cared about people, and everybody told me that was silly, that was wrong. I remember one particular time that I was looking at a picture of a book with a young baby starving in Africa or somewhere, and God, it bothered me. I showed it to one of my buddies. He said, who cares, man? Come on. And I thought, see, I'm wrong. I shouldn't feel that way. And lately I've understood in my sobriety as I continue on this journey that we're all on, that I was not wrong in feeling that way. The truth is, I was very right in feeling that way. And I spend most of my days in sobriety today remembering how I felt as a kid and trying to do that once again. How to love people unconditionally. How to care about people even if there's no strings attached. You know? My mistake was, and I assume your mistake was in certain areas, is I started changing how I felt by what you said to me. Like they said, don't be a wimp. Who cares, man? Come on out and play ball. So I learned real quick, you don't feel that way. Even if you do, you start lying about it. I don't care. I also don't know about you, but at a very early age, I started telling you that. I don't care. Who cares? I don't care. And it was a lie I come to believe. Vicious lie, but I come to believe it. I don't know when I took my first drink. I was young. I know that. I know my dad was a hard-working man. He worked as hard as he drank, and he did both daily. And he'd send me to the refrigerator to get a beer, and I'd get a sip for, as a reward when I come back. And as I got back, the sips, you know, as I got bigger, the sips got bigger, and pretty soon it was two beers, and pretty soon I wasn't letting him have any, you know. So we as the drunks are, I guess. I don't know. But I was so grateful for alcohol because I don't know about you, but it seemed to answer a question that I didn't know I was asking. And that's that question of what's wrong with me. I don't know that it went boom. I don't know that it went a lot of things, but it sure made life not matter so much. It sure kind of took the edge off. It sure kind of made it livable for a little while. Just for a little while. Had a tough time in school. Always had trouble with authority figures. My first day in kindergarten, I walked in, and I remember the teacher slapped me and sent me home. And I thought, well, we figured out what I think about school, you know. And I ground them every chance I get. They kicked me out of all public schools when I was in seventh grade. Somebody else was talking about that, and I understand that incorrigible. And I figured they just had a bad attitude, and if they'd straightened up, I'd have stayed. But they didn't, and I left. At the age of 13. And at the age of 13, I was arrested for possession of a sawed-off shotgun, and it wasn't to make friends with me. You know, it's just amazing that now we get nervous about kids shooting kids. So it's amazing me. It always amazes me that we get nervous now that it's in your neighborhood, but when it was in our neighborhood 37 years ago, nobody cared much. But in L.A. or Chicago today, 5-10 young people going to die just by drive-bys. And we say, oh, but not our school, thank God. Never understood that. Still don't. But I had that little 12-gauge sawed-off shotgun, and that was going to tell me, that was going to keep you away from me because I had already got to the point of don't hurt me anymore. I'd already started to be in my life to that point of if I hurt anymore, I'm just going to blow into a million pieces. I'm going to disintegrate. And I started in my life a course that I really didn't want to do, and that was take me out, please. I was a cop fighter from a very early age. And it ain't about being tough. It's about being crazy. You know, when I saw a badge, I swung. I swung. I went to my first AA meeting when I was 10 years old. I've got a brother sober so long they don't smoke around him anymore. Afraid he might go up in flames, you know. And I saw those same old people talked about. I mean, they were really old. They were up around 30. And I remember Fred standing up there and going, my name's Fred and I'm an alcoholic. And I thought, good for you, Fred, you know, gee. And the reason I tell you that is for a number of years after that, people tried to tell me about Alcoholics Anonymous, but they forgot one thing. I'm just like you. My problem is memories of what might have been, of what could have been, of if only. Of why'd I do that when I promised I would? Already. That's why I drank. I didn't have an alcohol problem. I didn't need 12 golden steps to walk up. I just needed you off my back for a while. And I want that rich family that I was stolen from when I was a baby to find me. Don't laugh, I still run the ad every now and then. My mother was a God-fearing woman, went to church every Sunday, and I learned about God at an early age, and what I learned I didn't like much. I don't know about you, but I'm of the opinion that all ministers have thin blue lips and talk like this. And they always seem to find me in the crowd and shake their finger at me like this. You're going to burn in hell, young man. And they'd say something else that really bothered me. It just made me crazy. Made me really anti-God. They'd say, God is responsible for everything. God is responsible for everything. So when I'd go home in the middle of the night and I'd turn on that light and there'd be a million cockroaches running everywhere and I'm trying to fight them off and get them off the glass so I could get a glass of water, I think God is responsible for everything. When Mom and Dad get into it one more time and the police come and there's blood all over and she's sobbing and they take Dad away, I think God is responsible for everything. When I got to fight them one more time because they made fun of my clothes and told me I smelled bad and that I was a loser because my brother was in the joint, I'd say God is responsible for everything. After a while, I didn't think God liked me very much. Didn't think it at all. Then they said, we need you to pray. Like, I'm going to tell him where I'm at. You know? I don't think so. He's finding me here and there and giving me enough trouble. You know, I don't know. So that's my qualifying. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous for a very basic reason. I couldn't stop drinking anymore. And yes, I did all that other stuff and just consider that I did it all, everything I could get my hands on, and that's qualifying enough. You see, I'm really simple about the whole deal. If it's addictive, it's trouble for me. That's being alcoholic, in my opinion, that I don't mess with any of that because I don't want to try it anymore. It was January 5th of 1971. I was laying in the middle of the street. It was 18 below zero. And just got in a car wreck, and I was laying in the middle of the street pretending like I was knocked out. I'm not sure why, but it seemed like a good idea at that moment. And the police came up, and I remember the police as clear as I hear your laughter right now. The police came up and said, that's Mutum, don't touch him, he's the scum of the earth. Car's probably hot, don't even cover that SOB. And a miracle happened. I agreed. For some reason, I understood that I was there as an end result of my own actions. Not my childhood, not my inner child or my outer child, or Mom and Dad's inner child or outer child. I was there because I drank, and I was there because I didn't know how to live. And it wasn't that people hadn't taught me or tried to teach me. It was that something inside of me wouldn't listen, and I guess I was ready to listen. And I remember they took me into the hospital and some nurse said, hey, Ed, do you want me to call A&A? And I went, might as well. Why can't you be sincere like we were in the old days? You know, might as well. And the next day, a guy came up to make a 12-step call on me named Hap. There's a good guy to see when you're hungover. A guy named Hap, smiling all the time, laughing and joking. I thought, get out of my room. You know. But I'd been to A&A. I'd been to A&A and I'd heard it all. We got a lot of people here that got sober young, and they heard it too. So I went up to one of them tonight, and I said, stuck out my hand and said, it's so nice to see you young people get here before you really had to hurt. You know, and they look at me just the way I looked at them. I'm going to kill them, you know? and they said things like, I spilled more than you ever drank. You're not even around the block. Now, by the time I was 20 years old and came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had records as long as both of my arms. I'd been married and divorced, committed to the Iowa State Mental Institution, termed psychotic, neurotic, insanely violent, hopelessly addicted to drugs, and chronic alcoholic. And I come to these meetings, and they say, you ain't even been around the block yet. And I started saying, how big is this block? Because if it's much bigger, I ain't going to make it. But I was a little annoyed with AA, too. They lied to me. They lied to me. It was almost like a promise they made. And people say, I've never been lied to in AA. I have. I come to AA, and they said, you keep doing what you're doing, you're going to die. And I thought, cool. Where do I sign up? Don't you get it? That's why I drink anyway. It's because I can't stand sober. And you want me to get sober. And what you don't understand is as soon as I get sober, the voices start and the anger starts, and sooner or later, I'm going to have to hurt somebody, or they're going to have to hurt me, or I'm going to have to get loaded. So please tell me I'm going to die. It'd be a relief. What helps keep me sober is I understood that day also that I might live a long, long time and feel that same way or worse forever. And I started going to meetings, and I remember started going to the meetings, and one guy come up and put his arm around me. I said, I love you. And I said, I don't play that stuff, man. I'm just here to get sober, you know. I know I'm cute and all, but leave me alone, you know. And when I saw that same man a few weeks ago at a meeting, 2 weeks ago, at a friend of ours' funeral, I hugged him and I told him I loved him too. And I want to spend a little bit about that because you don't hear much about it anymore. It's, or at least that, not where I've been. And that's, I always had love confused with sex. Always did. And so when people talk about love, I felt a little funny because that's the only closeness I've ever known. When they talk to you about love in Alcoholics Anonymous, they're talking to you about a new treat if you be like me and if you feel like I used to feel. They're talking to you about an emotion that's going to touch your heart so deeply that sex can't even come close to. That's what love is. And that's what's in Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember I'd go to meetings and another guy that I work with every day, he was in there and he was a minister, had thin blue lips. I told you, they all got thin blue lips. And I was about 3 months sober. At about 3 months sober, you get honesty. At about 6 months, you get a little tact to go along with it, you know. Trust me, wait for the tact. Just trust me. And he asked me one day, he said, Ed, why don't you come back to church? And I said, I'll tell you why I don't go back to church. It's full of thieves, hypocrites, and liars. Felt good. He looked back at me and said, why don't you come? One more won't hurt. Punished him. I didn't talk to him for months. And I had my look. I don't know if you got a look. I had a look. I had a look that'd give you, that'd drive you four blocks back, and that's just what it was meant to do. It was to keep you away from me at all cost. Because if you got close to me, I was terrified you were going to hurt me again. And my heart would break, and I'd die. So I had my look. I can't even do my look anymore. I used to do it so good, too. But it was a sneer, and it was a look that just put you off, kind of like some of them looking back at me now. But I've been there, too. No. But I had my look. And I walked into the meeting, I had my look on, didn't know it. Walked in, one guy said, how you feeling, Ed? And I said, fine. And they said, why don't you tell your face? You don't know. Yeah. Another little habit I picked up along the way to break, yeah. And I didn't know. I didn't know how to tell you when I felt good. They asked me to be honest how I felt. I had lied for so long, I didn't know how I felt. These people go through treatment and do something in 28 days. I don't know if I was given my right name at 28 days, let alone taking an inventory and finding God. I don't know. Maybe that's good. It wouldn't have been for me. And that was the other thing. When I got sober, it bothered me quite a bit. They started saying the G word out loud. And it talks in our book about being violently anti-religious, and that's exactly where I was. You talk to me about God, I'll take you up. Man or a woman, I don't care. I don't care. I was that afraid. I thought two things. If there is a God, I'm in trouble. And guess what? I was right on both points. But I didn't want to hear that stuff. And I got a little bristly. And then they said to me, you know, it's God as you understand them. And I said, you mean I can get my own? I said, yeah. I said, anything you conceive God to be will be God. And I really fixed them because I thought, my God's going to be kind and loving. I'll show them jerks, you know. So I was walking around with a kind and loving God, and I was going to meetings, and I did something that I hope you never do, and if you do, or if you're doing it, I hope you stop. And I started professing a faith that I didn't believe. Now, it's confusing because you'll hear a lot of speakers say, act as if, and I understand that. But don't get it confused with reality. If you're professing a faith, make sure it's yours. Not some nice words you heard a speaker say at a roundup or a good old-timer at a meeting or a newcomer at a meeting. Make sure you believe it. You know, the last place we ever try to have an honest relationship is with our very own God. It's the last place we ever look. And we wonder why he don't want to hang around. Or God, whoever you conceive God to be, doesn't want to hang around. But I started professing a faith, and I'd hear things in meetings, and the people that talked about God, I'd look into their eyes, and they were telling the truth. I knew they were telling the truth. I could look at them and see what they were talking about is the truth. So I listened to them. I spent a lot of time on the streets. I had to know where you were coming from. My life was in your hand. And if I misjudged where you were coming from, my life was in trouble. And when I saw that in their eyes, something melted inside of me. And I listened. But I went to meetings and I started pontificating. I started talking about a faith that I longed to have, maybe, but I didn't know too much about. And that's okay for some people, I guess. It wasn't for me. I was sober about a year in this program, and I was going around the country. I went to a lot of meetings. They asked me to get a sponsor, and I asked a couple people to be my sponsor, so if anybody asked who my sponsor was, I could give them their name. I never bothered them, mind you. But I didn't want to get personally involved with my life. But, you know, they believed in sponsorship, so I got one, made them happy. And I was doing a lot of things and going around a lot of places, and I got into the addiction field for a while, and I'm real grateful I got out of there. It's good for some people, bad for people like me. And that's all I'll say about that. But, I was doing a lot of stuff, and I was sober a year, and I'd just come home. I'd been around the country talking a lot. And my dad said to me, come over for dinner tonight. And I went, uh-oh. Because when my old man asked me over for dinner, I'm in trouble. You know what I mean? It's not like we weren't Beaver Cleaver stuff. And when he said, you remember. when he said that, I got a little nervous, to be quite honest with you. But I'd been around AA, and they told me a few things that I had to do. Number one, if I don't change my old attitudes, I'm still living on them. So I got to approach situations with a new positive attitude and a new way of life. You know, if I keep thinking the same old thing, nothing will change. If I keep thinking the same about God, about program, about it, it's not going to change. So I showed up. I showed up for dinner, and about halfway through dinner, he said, boy, and I went, here we go. He said, I want to tell you something. I'm proud of you. And the world stopped momentarily. If you had told me I wanted that old fool's approval, I would have said, you're crazy. It means nothing. Absolutely nothing. It was one of the best days of my life. He said he was proud of me. And God, almost broke the buttons on my shirt, and I went to the meeting, and after the meeting, I went to my sister-in-law's house, and I got a call from my mother, who was crying and hysterical, and said, Ed, come home. Dad went across the street to the tavern, and now they're carrying bodies out, and I don't know what's going on. And I drove across to Davenport, Iowa that night, and it was a nice storm, and it was hard to get there, and I kept thinking, well, now that I got me a God, everything's good. Nothing bad's ever going to happen again. It's got to be okay. And I got there, and I walked into that murder scene that I was to find was a murder scene, and there was policemen there that, oddly enough, in the last year, they'd shaped up pretty good, you know. Funny how they stop arresting you when you stop swinging at them. It's just amazing. But they had watched me closely, and they knew that I was sober. And I walked in there, and I remember the officer said, "Ed, what are you doing here?" And I said, "My dad came in here." He said, "Oh, my God, Ed." He said, "All I can tell you is somebody come in and opened fire and shot everybody." He said, "We've taken everybody up to the hospital, and you can go up there and check." And I looked down the bar, and I saw this pool of blood with my father's glasses all mangled up in them. So I said, "Okay," and I went up to the hospital. And I went up there to the hospital, and there was an officer there who hadn't forgiven me for my past. And he said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "I'm here to see if my dad's one of the guys that were shot down in Shamrock." He said, "I've identified everybody. Now get your ass out of here before we bust you." Sorry about the language, just reporting. And a miracle happened. I just said, "Okay," and I left. I didn't tear him apart. I was thinking about that a while back. 1 year before that, he would have been in a world of trouble. And I said, "Okay," and I went and called the very officer that spent the last 5 years of his career, or my drinking career, I should say, trying to put me away, getting me in the back of his car and saying things to me like, "If I see you leaving the scene of the crime or think I see you leaving the scene of the crime, I'm going to shoot to kill and not stop." And my answer would be, "Everything's fair in love and war, chump. Otherwise, please take me out. Stop the pain." I called him up and I said, "Chuck, my dad was in that bar, and he knew I was sober. He had a lot of people tailing me." And he said, "Oh, my God, Ed," and he fed me info as it came in. We searched the streets all night. We came up with the conclusion that it was either a hostage situation or he'd been shot and staggered outside somewhere. So we formed a search party. And for 8 hours, we searched the streets, and I looked under parked cars and in garbage cans. And the only thing that God had given me that night is the only thing I needed, but it was a serenity prayer. One word at a time. That's all that had to go through my head. As I looked in garbage cans and under porches, you didn't want to look, but you know you got to look, because he may be there. 8 o'clock the next morning, that officer called me up and said, "Well, that anybody could have made a mistake. You want to come up and identify your dad?" I said, "Sure." And I went up to the hospital, and I walked into that morgue, and I saw that bullet hole in my father's face, and it got very cold in that morgue. Very cold. God is responsible for everything. They told me he'd get me. They told me I'd have to pay one day for all I've ever done. They told me I'd pay, and a man did I get angry. I thought, you know, God, you had to pick on a weak old man. Why didn't you try me on? Why didn't you try me on? God, I was angry. And I left there in the... You know, I was thinking recently, too, there's been a lot of reason lately to go over all that situation. And I remember everywhere I looked and everywhere I went, there was an AA member there. Not right up in my, but everywhere I went, courthouse, funeral home, everywhere I went, getting out in my car, somebody, AA member, would be sitting in his car. Only took me 28 years to realize that. Everywhere I went, there was an AA member, and you see, they were just like my God. They were there if I needed him. Otherwise, they'd let me do whatever I had to do. They were there if I needed them. And I went to my father's funeral, and like I said, I was so angry. Man, I was angry. And the man that did my father's funeral gave me the keys to the kingdom, I believe. He said, "You know, a lot of people would say Clifford's death is God's will." He said, "I don't believe that." And I sat right up in the pew. He said, "You know, God created human beings and gave them a free will. Some of them chose to do this act, and now it's God's will." "You mean God's weeping as much as I am? You mean it breaks his heart when he sees stuff like this too? You mean it's creations of our own head and our own self-will run riot that does this?" And the answer is yes. "You mean the reason people are starving in the world? It's very simple, because we're not feeding them. Don't blame God. You mean the reason cancer's rampant in this world? It's very simple. We pollute everything we touch and want to blame it on everybody else." I was talking to some people over lunch. 30, 35 years ago, we didn't know anybody with cancer. Now you don't know anybody without it. Almost. Can't blame that on God. And when he said that, the weight of the world fell off my shoulders. That maybe that God I made up, maybe, kind and loving, maybe. I had to go to one of the murder trials, and I remember a guy sitting there, young guy with a big old afro, and they were trying him, and my father ended up being shot because he was white, and it was the bottom line, and this guy was sitting there, and I'd been born, raised up very prejudiced. He was looking at me and giving me a nasty look, and I thought, you know, you give me 5 minutes with this guy, we won't have to waste all this money. In fact, bring all five of them in and put me in a room with them. You won't have to waste a dime. Yet I was going to meetings, and they said I had to act with dignity and respect. That out there I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous on that trial bench. That people be looking at me. And I needed to act better than I felt. And so I did, and I went. My God, I was so glad when that trial was over. And for the most part, I'd put that behind me. And I went into work one day. I was working in Galesburg, Illinois, and God talked to me. Now, you got to be careful when God talks to you. Got a few other guys God talked to. They'll be out in about another 10 years. But God talked to me and said, Ed, go out to California. Get into show business. Made sense to me. So I packed my bags and I went to where all stars get their start, Anaheim, California. I got a job at Disneyland. I was goofy. Little did they know how well I fit the role at that point, I'll tell you. 2.5 years sober, no sponsor, quit reading that big book. Oh, step on Goofy's little shoes, will you? You know. Yeah. Could have been big problems in River City with that one, but the truth of the matter is I did get the job. I never started it because something got in my way. A guy came into the Anaheim Club one day and said, you want to go to a meeting in West L.A.? And I said, sure. And I went up to that meeting, and I walked into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous where they were happy, and they were talking about living, and they were talking about helping each other, and they were talking about carrying the message, not the verbal message, carrying the message physically and in any way you can. Really doing it. They talked about being active in institution and service, and that in anybody in the group moved, we moved them, you know? And it was just great, and I thought, man, because I was used to going into meetings where you stood up the old-timer once a year, dusted them off, and flipped them a chip, you know? See you next year, Barney, you know. And I'm in this meeting, and people are just happy and excited, and they're talking about life, and I thought, cool. And I come up the next week, and there was this guy standing there, and I said, excuse me, would you be my sponsor? He said, no. And I said, why not? He said, anybody I sponsor has to look up to me. I thought, good, tall jokes, that's what I need. That'll help me out. A few minutes later, he came over and he stuck out his hand. He said, my name's Clancy. I'll be glad to be your sponsor. And I am forever grateful I ran into him. And I am forever grateful I didn't hear half the garbage that goes around about him, or I would have been dead. It was God working through Alcoholics Anonymous, working through Clancy I, that saved my life. He was the first guy in AA I ever ran into that he looked right into my eyes, and I was telling him I was fine, and he knew I was stark raving sober. And that suicide looked wonderful. That I'd go to bed at night praying I wouldn't wake up. That I'd go home from meetings that I just talked at saying, everything's wonderful, day at a time, live and let live. And I'm looking at bridge abutments as I go home and I say, well, at least I won't drink. And the insurance will take care of all my bills. You see, when all that happened with my father, I went up to a few old-timers in AA. And I sat down and I tried to tell them how I felt. And if you've ever had anybody murdered, you feel homicidal. You feel violent. And if you've been raised in a neighborhood, an eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth, you feel tremendous guilt that you haven't done something. And I told them how I was feeling, and they got up and walked away and said, I thought you had a good program. So I learned something there. Don't be honest in AA. Don't be honest here, because they'll just walk away from you. So it's been a long time since I've been honest with anybody in AA. I had the answer. You know what it was? How are you, Ed? Fine. You? Fine. Got some fines this weekend. Yeah. Be happy to talk to you after the meeting, Mrs. and Mr. Fine. Because when I was fine, I was saying, just marking time. Just went out of this deal somehow, if there's any way. And he could see that in my eyes. And he insisted I do things that nobody should be asked to do. And he didn't ask, he told, and I'm forever grateful he told me. I always get a kick out of people that say, oh, I wasn't told anything. And we're here because alcohol and drugs told us to do everything in life. I've been told what to do, just not by good forces. It's always been bad. And he said I had to write another inventory. And he said, oh, he sent me to this meeting, and it's small at that time. It's only about 400 people. He said, I want you to go out there and shake everybody's hand. And I said, I don't like them people. He said, they don't like you either. Go shake their hand. Hi, I'm Ed. Hi, I'm Ed. Yeah, I'm Ed. Had a tad of an anger problem, as you might touch. When I actually worked the steps, that disappeared, but it didn't until I did. But he suggested that I write an inventory. I wrote 4 days and four nights, put all my heart in that inventory. I mean, I told the truth even. And went into Clancy's house to have a cup of coffee with his wife, Charlotte, and celebrate having done my four step and walked back out to the garage. And at that time, Clancy had a goat named Alfred. And Alfred was finishing off the last page. Ate the whole thing. When I go into the house, I say, Charlotte, that goat ate my inventory. She said, oh, my God, I hope he don't get the run. Typical Al-Anon answer, I say, you know. Clancy came back, and I said, Clancy, that goat ate my inventory. He said, bet you found that hard to swallow. Bad news is, 3 days later, the goat died. Some sort of intestinal blockage. He still says, boy, I'm glad I didn't read that first one. But he started telling me things like, I got to act better than I feel. And I didn't know what he meant by that, but I'll tell you something I did not know. You see, before I got sober, I thought if I thought it, it was the truth. It just was. If the thought crossed my mind to punch you, congratulations, you're on the floor, you know. But I didn't know. I really didn't know. I thought, you know, that maybe you were out to get me or something, and, you know. And he said, I want you to act better than you feel. And I'll give you a little example. He had a lot of weight in Santa Monica, California, pulled a lot of strings, and I got to be a bellhop, and they gave me a little coat that just fit great. And I had a little blue hat on. And I'd sit there from 11 to 7, and little old ladies would come in and drop their bag on my foot. And they'd say, pick up that bag, boy. And I'd think, which one? You were it. But he told me I could think that. I had to watch how I act. And I picked it up, and I'd go upstairs, and I'd put it into the room, and I'd open it up, and I'd go to the door, and I'd wait for the tip. She slammed the door, and I'd like to break my fingers. And I think, I'm going to kick in the door, grab this old broad floor out the window and watch her splatter. But what I did is say, thank you, and I went downstairs. May not sound like much to you, but I'll tell you what it was. It's called freedom from the bondage of self. It's step three. I had no idea of that. Freedom from the bondage of self. It's called something else. It's called faith. I don't care how bad you're feeling. Do the right thing. Faith. Faith that it's going to be all right no matter how you feel. And I'll tell you something. If he would have put it to me that way, I wouldn't have done it. But the way he put it to me, I could do it. And I remember Chuck C., who I love dearly, who one of my deepest regrets is that he's not around anymore. Not for me, but for you. Because I'd sit at this guy's knee and he'd talk to me and he'd give me things that I still carry with me today. I really do. I could ask him questions that I couldn't ask any other human being. Like, Chuck, how do you pray? I mean, really, how do you pray? And he said, Eddie, your every thought's a prayer. And I went, oh, God. But I thought about that. Why would I be thinking things I'm ashamed of? Why would I even want them in my head if God wouldn't approve of them? Here I am supposedly trying to build this relationship and keeping the garbage going. So I started trying to make every thought a prayer. And at that time it was about 95% bad and 5% good. And I've got those numbers switched now. And I'm real grateful about it and I work on it every single day. But I want my every thought to be a prayer. It's called praying unceasingly. Why not? And I remember asking those tough questions to Clancy. I said, Clancy, how do you be kind and loving? He said, you act that way. And, jeez, I would have never thought of that. I wouldn't have. Don't you have to pick something or do something or talk to me or investigate it? Or No, just do it. It's like steps. Do them. Better do them, you know. And they work. And oddly enough, people started talking to me about how kind I was. And nobody'd ever said that to me before. Everybody was always afraid of me. I did a good job of keeping you away. After a while, I learned to start watching my mouth and my sarcastic humor and having fun at your expense. My little cute one-liners that would bring you to your knees and offering unsolicited advice. I don't do that anymore. If I got something to share with somebody I think they need to hear, I go up to them and say, would you mind some unsolicited advice? And most times they say, no, go ahead. Sometimes they go, I don't want to hear. I say, good, I'm gone. But I got to give you the dignity of your own choice. It's like the gossip that goes around about a lot of people in AA and a lot of members in AA and a lot of groups. I don't hear it. I don't play it. I may not think anything of them, but they may save your life, and I want you to have the dignity of your own decision. Nobody appointed me God. I want you to have the decision of who you're going to associate with and what you're going to do. I believe in strong sponsorship. A lot of people don't. I hear a lot of stuff about that. I'll tell you, I've narrowed it down to who has a problem with strong sponsorship. One type of person, the ones that need strong sponsorship. I figured it out. I've even figured out why they got, you know, here's the answer. If they were secure in their own program, they wouldn't have to put somebody else's down. That's the reality of it. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love being sober, and I'd go to meetings, and I'd, one day Clancy said, you can do much better than you ever thought, Ed, and I said, okay. And he encouraged me to do things I never thought I could do. I remember one time I had started all over with God, and I'd started an honest relationship. I got down on my knees, and I said, God, I have no idea whether you're there or not. I sure hope so. And I said that prayer, and I said that prayer upstairs before I came down here tonight. The prayer I said was, I was going out to Pasadena, California to speak at an AA meeting, and Pasadena is a very wealthy area, and I was living in Venice, and I was broke. And I said, oh, Venice, man, or Pasadena, wealthy area, I might get a job, might get hooked up, and I caught myself, and I went right back in, opened the bathroom door, got down on my knees, and I said the prayer I said upstairs, and I said, Father, forgive me. Let me go and share the miracles of Alcoholics Anonymous and what you've done in my life, and I want absolutely nothing for it. Absolutely nothing. You've already overpaid me. And I went to that meeting and I talked, and afterwards a guy came up to me and said, this makes no sense to me, but I want to offer you a job. I said, it makes perfect sense to me. No problem. He said, have you ever been in Taiwan? No. You ever been in show business management? No. He said, be in my office Monday morning. Went to his office Monday morning. You told me to suit up and show up, so I did. Went to his office Monday morning, had an interview. The producer liked me Thursday. I was lifting out of LAX going to Taipei, Taiwan. I was new vice president of America on Ice. I had a cast of 62. I was flying over there to negotiate contracts with the Taiwanese government and their suppliers to build stages and costumes for the 63 staff that was coming over. And how was your week? Now, I'm going to tell you something. If you ask for things, be prepared to walk toward them. I have come to believe that the biggest problem people have in AA is wanting to remain where they're at. It's a sickness, I believe. A lot of people have been getting drunk lately with long-term sobriety. Haven't moved in years. But the toughest thing I have to do as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous is when the good things come, walk toward them. It's easy to sit in the same old stuff. It's familiar. What we're called to do, and what I understand in this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and our steps, is to change that. I could have sat there when they said, be in my office Monday morning. I could have said, you don't understand, I have a seventh grade education. I'm kind of a white trash guy. Not too bright, because Dad always said I was a dumb SOB. And I just showed up. And they gave me the job. And I went. And I got off the plane in Taipei, Taiwan, and everybody's this tall. And they're looking at me, and I'm looking at them, you know. I know it's just a matter of time before they break out that rope and tie me down. And a lot of things went on there that I don't have time to go into tonight, but suffice to say that it was a position God had put me in to give me talents I would have never believed I had. Thank God I didn't sit where I was comfortable. Thank God I was put in a position that sometimes scared me, and I had to walk forward in faith. My term was, guess it's time to punt. But what that meant was just walk forward. Just walk forward and believe it's going to be all right. I was in Kaohsiung, and some guy walked by me and said, you know, you'd be an excellent manager for the Harlem Globetrotters. And I went, yeah, yeah. He's on drugs, I knew it. You know, I'm just... And I was home 3 months, and the Harlem Globetrotters called me up. They said, Mr. Mutum, we've heard wonderful things about you. Would you come in and talk to us? And I said, surely. And I got up my best suit and went up Sunset Boulevard and walked into the office of the Harlem Globetrotters and reported, because that's where they asked me to report. I was told when I'm asked to do something, do it. And 8 hours later, they said, congratulations, you're the new manager of the Harlem Globetrotters. Now, when I got sober, I was 8 years sober at this time, 9 years maybe. When I got sober in Davenport, Iowa, those old-timers told me something. They said, I want you to go back and dig up your dreams, whatever they were, and go after them again. And I said, no, you don't understand. I had great dreams. I had great dreams. And they said, no, you don't understand. We want you to pick them up again and walk toward them. You know what my dreams were? I wanted to travel all over the world. I wanted to meet kings and queens and presidents. And I wanted to go first class. And guess how the Harlem Globetrotters travel? I don't dream anymore. You know why? What God's got in mind for me is so much better than what I could come up with. I really believe that I don't want to limit God by my narrow mind and limit him. I don't know how big your God is, but I hope he's a big one. I hope he's one that can change your heart and your mind and even this world. Why not? Why not? And I went off and I was manager of the Harlem Globetrotters and we traveled the world. And I was in London and I met the daughter of the Turkish ambassador. She was a Muslim, absolutely gorgeous, most gorgeous woman I've ever seen in my life. Wealthy, rich, well-educated. I figured our backgrounds were a lot alike, so we should get married. I didn't say all your judgment returns, you know. I just... But I remember, I've never really talked about it. I remember sitting, we had a lot of suits made over on Carnaby Street in London, was the place to have them then. And she worked for a guy named Colin Wilde, who was one of the best designers in London at that time. Can you imagine this? I mean, listen to this. East 6th Street, Davenport, Iowa, the slums, Carnaby Street. I was there, it's true. And, But she worked for him, and she was just gorgeous. Every time I'd get just enough courage to ask her out, some star had come in, some British star, Billy Ocean, or one of them. Hi, Arnell, would you like to get out? No. And she'd sit back, I'd sit back down, I think. And I sat there for 2 weeks. We were in London for 2 weeks, and I kept trying to get up courage to ask her out. And I kept buying her coffee. That's what I learned in A, buy coffee, you know. coffee. And to her sewing machine, there's like 30 cups of coffee. And it's like into the second week I've been there, you know. And she liked cheese and cucumber sandwiches. So she had cheese and cucumber sandwiches everywhere. And I kept thinking. And finally I went up to her and I said, would you go out with me tonight? I said, it's the last night we're playing at Wembley. I'll put you in the Queen's box. And afterwards we'll go to the Playboy Club because they always give us carte blanche. And we'll dance the night away and... we'll just have a good time. Would you like to do that? And she said, I don't know. And I said, no, you don't understand. I can't do I don't know. I can do yes. I can do no. But I can't do I don't know. And she said, if I'll be there, I'll be there when your limo leaves the hotel. And I went downstairs to get the limo, and there she was. And she's just wonderful. She still is. She's still one of the most beautiful women I've ever known. We got in the vehicle and went and played the game, and we went to the Playboy Club in London that night and danced the night away. And her house was about 20 minutes out of London, 20, 30 minutes out of London, I guess it was. We got a taxi, we rode, and I got out of the car, and she got out of the car, and I took her hand, and I kissed it, and I said, thank you. She said, for what? And I said, I never thought I'd ever even get to know anybody like you. let alone get to spend some time with him. And I got him attached and I left. You see, you taught me here to be a gentleman, too. She don't owe me nothing. I owe her my respect. Oddly enough, about 2 months later, I was in Spain and the phone rang and she said, "Why haven't you called?" I said I didn't know I was supposed to. But we got married, John. And we ended up with 3 beautiful kids and were married for 10 years and it ended in divorce because of a lot of difficulties we had. One, I wasn't a good partner at that time. I was a terrible partner. I thought I was pretty good, but in retrospect, I lacked a lot. And she lacked a lot because I was her first real relationship, too. So both of us come in handicapped, but I admire and I respect her today. And she's a terrific gal. We don't talk much because she wants to argue. And I don't want to argue anymore. But I love her and I pray for her every single day that she finds happiness and peace of mind. And her career has taken off. 1988. I'm in California and I'm wheeling and dealing. I'm doing it. I got me my little Mercedes, you know, and I got me $2,500 a month pad in Burbank, California, right by NBC Studios, and I'm making it happen. And somebody knocked on my door with an eviction notice, and I thought, oops, might be a problem here. Seems they want you to keep paying those bills. That's the start of it. It's an amazing thing. But what I had really done, all kidding aside, was I had made decisions based on self that cost me everything I owned. I have no one to blame, nor do I want to blame anyone. I made a real bad decision based on self that cost me everything I owned. And so I went back to Iowa, and I'm glad I did. 1988, I went back there, and I had to start all over. And I lived on a little house on 6th Street, oddly enough. And it's a little slum area that I just love, and I drove down there the other day, and I just like to hang out. Because there's an honesty in that neighborhood that you don't find a lot of places. People used to come up to me and say, "You live in that neighborhood? Aren't you afraid they'll steal something from you?" And I'd say, "They're in your neighborhood looking, not in mine, you know." And I started doing the things. I started reading that book again, and I read the part where it said we were reborn, and I decided to take it literally. Why not? Somebody said the other night, "This isn't rocket science. This isn't rocket science." Really? Why does it say we're rocketed into a fourth dimension of living then? It is rocket science. It's designed to put me into a position of living that I've never known before, and I don't think any less of it than that. I used to think that was always for you. But that night in 1988, when I was there and I'd lost everything I owned, I decided to make it for me. That possibly if I do what they said in that book and quit trying to pick it apart and do a little song and dance on specific words, that if I just did it, my life may change. In fact, it will change. And so I did. And I started a little place for people to stay. It was not a halfway house. It was not a treatment center. I just saw a lot of people who were in need, trying to stay sober, young people that had no place to stay. And I learned a long time ago that I quit criticizing anything I'm not doing my part to correct. My conversations are limited a lot of times, but at least I'm not as hypocritical, you know? And so I decided to start a place, and we started a place, and people started coming there and lived, and they couldn't get over it because I didn't want anything from them. All I wanted was the opportunity to love them and help them. And when, I hope they go to meetings. And I did that for 2.5 years, and then I started back to work. I thought, well, might as well pay some bills. It looks like they're not going away. And I started back to work, and I quit smoking. I'd smoked for 32 years. And one day I was, I thought, maybe this isn't good for you. So I quit. And I had tried for a long time. I'll tell you, there's a lot of people trying and struggling with that. And when I finally quit is when I started stop making it a big deal, and I just did it. That really worked for me. And also understanding that I had more faith in something that big than I did my God. There's some information you don't want. Because every time I had more faith that this would calm me down than a few prayers. Every single time. And so the doctor told me I had to start exercising, doing this and that, so I did that. And I got the right shoes, and I'm stretching, and I'm doing all this. And they said, go out and run. So I went out and ran, and I broke my leg. You know, there would have been a time when I would have said, God broke my leg to teach me something. I would have. I remember a few years back, I was walking down the steps going to talk somewhere, and I slipped, and my arm caught in the banister, and I went down, and man, when 330 pounds are going down, it goes down hard. And man, almost broke my arm. It really hurt, and I got to the back door, and I slipped again, and I rammed my head into the door, and I had a big old goose egg here, you know? There would have been a time in my sobriety when first thing that happened, I'd think, God's punishing me for my past offenses. And the second one would have been, maybe God doesn't want me to go and talk. What I did this time is I went up and took off those slippery shoes. And I went to talk. You know, you really got to get to the point, if you're like me, where you got to quit blaming God for everything that happens. I hear people say, God's testing me. That's right. He stops everything in the world just to screw with your day, you know? Possibly you're a little too self-obsessed, won't they? And I was home taking an inventory. I was kind of patting myself on the back thinking, well, you know, I'm doing pretty good. And God said to me, why don't you get an education? And when God talks to me, he talks very loud and very clear. And I even went, la, 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 la. There's no call waiting. He kept coming back, you know. And so I did what I did. If you're around AA for a while and you get a message like that, you get your crutches and you hobble on over to the university and you walk in. And I remember walking in that day and I said, I need to go to school. And they said, how many credits do you have? I said, I have bad credits. Why? And they said, no, credits or unit that you go to school with. And I said, no, you need to understand something. I shared a gift with them that I just love, and I thank you for it. I thank Alcoholics Anonymous for it. I looked them right in the eye, and I said, you need to understand something. I don't know anything about going to school. I got booted out of school in seventh grade. I don't know if I can read real well. But if you can help me, I want to try. And they said, sure, we'll help you. And I started going to school, and I remember the first semester I got on the dean's list. And I went to school, and they said, you're on the dean's list. And I said, for what? I've been busting my behind. They put me on some list, you know. And they said, no, Ed, that's good. And I went, oh, okay, yes, you're good. And I thought I'd get a few hours. And shortly after that, I went on a Christian retreat, and I had no less than a spiritual awakening. And God talked to me, and he said he needed me to help him in any way I can. And he needed me to be in his service. And I was called into the ministry, and I've never looked back. And that was a little over 6 years ago. And my life has never been better. And I didn't question it except one time. One time I thought, God, you know who you're calling here? This is Ed. Remember Ed, the big guy? You sure? And I'm joking about it, but it was dead serious because, you see, I knew something. I knew I had to hold me to a standard that I'd never thought of holding me before. And that's me. But I knew if I was going to do this, it had to be right. And I said, God, I don't mean to bargain with you, but show me if it's right. Would you show me if it's right? And I sure didn't know much scripture then, and I know a little more now because I study it, and I've been a lot of education on it. And I just opened my Bible to a place in 1 Timothy that says, paraphrased, it says simply this, I've chosen you to be in my service because you're a blasphemer and a man who hurt my people. You are the worst of the worst. Who better to show my mercy and my grace than through you? And I shut that book, and I've never had to worry whether God likes me again. You see, it's his good pleasure, the worst you've been, to come into your heart and heal it. It's his good pleasure to, wherever you've been, no matter how bad you think you are, to pull you up out of that and let you live. It's his good pleasure. At least that's my God. And so I left there, and I was assigned two churches immediately, and a lot of good things happened. The first time somebody came up and asked me to baptize the baby, I cried like a baby. It just touched my heart. I never thought I'd get to do anything like that. First time one of my friends died in the congregation, they called me up and said old Harold had cancer, severe cancer. And Harold was one of the most honest, sincere men I've ever met in my life. I would just give him anything I owned. I just loved him. He was a hard-working farmer, and he would do anything for you. And I went to see Harold, and I stopped in. It was a radical stomach cancer that was going quick. And I sat there, and I thought, well, I'm doing on-the-job training with this pastor deal. I thought, well, he's probably supposed to pray or something. I don't know. But I didn't feel like praying, so I sat there. And I started talking to Harold, and Harold every once in a while would look out his bay window. And Harold always kept his yard beautiful. And when I looked out his window, his yard was a little long. And I said, "Harold, can I mow your lawn?" And he looked back at me and he smiled and said, "Would you, Ed?" And I said, "Oh, yeah, it'd be my good pleasure." And for the next 3 months, every Monday, for 3.5 hours, I'd mow his lawn. I didn't learn that in seminary. I learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous, to do whatever you can to help one another. And nothing's too much and nothing's too little. As long as you do it out of love with no strings attached. And I finished that yard one day and I went into Harold and I said, "Harold, you ready to pray?" And he said, "Yep, sure am, Pastor Ed." And I said a prayer, man. It was a powerful prayer. I believe in prayer. It's the most powerful thing I can do for anybody. And I finished that prayer and I said, "God bless you, Harold." And he said, "No, no, no. God bless you, Ed." He left giving. And 2 hours later, he passed away. People said, "How do you do that? How did you know to do that?" And I said, "You don't understand. It's been done for me. You don't understand. I've been around the best people in the world who took a guy who had no right to be here and welcomed me into his home and left me there to watch that kid and fed me and told me they loved me long before I knew what it was." Last October, I was preaching, giving them heaven. You got to do that because they had enough of hell, you know.
"You're going to burn in hell. That's what you're going to do."
I tried to give them heaven, and I've been promoted to this church, a little church, 1,200 members, Asbury and Bettendorf, Iowa. If you're ever in town, please come by because I'm here by their grace. They have taken it as part of their mission to let me go one Sunday a month to go share my experience, strength, and hope with the members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's by their grace, truly, as well, that I'm here. But I was preaching up a storm, and I was talking about forgiveness. And forgiveness has been in my heart for a long time because I really believe this. Your willingness to unforgive is your direct proportion to your relationship with God. In direct proportion, right in the middle of that sermon, I said, stopped, and I said, I got to tell you something here. I've never forgiven the guys that murdered my father. And I make a covenant with you right here, I said, that I'll find them and I'll forgive them. 2.5 weeks later, as God would have it, one of the sentences of one of the men was overturned. And the press called me up and they said, what do you think about all this? And I said, it's time to forgive and it's time to heal. It's been 28 years. If there's been an injustice toward this man, I want it righted. And he said, well, what if it gets out? What if he gets out? And I said, if he gets out, he can come live with me. And people were taken back by that. And honestly, I still don't quite get it. What else could I offer? What have you done for me? What else is he? When it's time to be an example, it's time to be an example. And they were just amazed by this. And I mean, it literally went all over the world. And 2020 was calling me, and Oprah, and everybody's calling me. And kind of made me wonder, you know, because we see it here all the time, you see. This is what we're supposed to be doing. It's called Step 8 and 9. My forgiveness wasn't contingent on his contriteness. My forgiveness was just my side of the street, you see. And you and I know that. And within a very short period of time, I was able to walk into that prison and walk down that hall and see that young man that 28 years before I wanted 5 minutes with. And I was able to walk up to him and I'd stick out my hand and look him dead in the eye, just like you looked me in the eye when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, I'm here to tell you that I forgive you, I love you, and God loves you. And if there's anything in my life I can do or give you that'll add to your life, let me do it. And there's a great hymn called Here I Am, Lord. And there's a line in there that says, I will melt their hearts of stone. And my friend Sherman's heart melted. Because you see, he looked into my eyes and he saw what I saw in your eyes. A God that he didn't understand, but he knew was real. And he didn't know too much about it, but he wanted to learn. So we've been learning together for the last few months. The county attorney swore he'd retry him. And you see, in the state of Iowa, if you're with somebody in the act of a killing and you're with them, all you got to be is with them, you're guilty of first-degree murder and spend the rest of your life in prison. And by his own testimony, he was there. So I went down to the county attorney and I asked him for mercy. And he said, Ed, this guy's conning me. I said, no, he's not conning me. He said, how do you know he's not conning me? I said, because he don't even know I'm here. He hasn't asked me for anything. But I want him to have a chance at living just like I'm living, on the sunlight of the Spirit, on the sunny side of the street. I want him to have the best, at least have a chance at it. And we talked for a little while, and as God would have it, the guy that went down there with me was the prosecuting attorney on the murder case who was handed my file at the same time, and they told him, you might as well get familiar with Ed because you'll spend your career prosecuting him, because they still didn't know whether I was going to stay sober, and that guy and I were going to seminary together. And we went in to talk to him, and he didn't retry him, and he let him plead to a lesser sentence, and he pled second-degree murder 3 times, and aggravated the robbery, and they gave him 65 years, and he cried, and I cried, and he came over and he hugged me, and I hugged him, and the reason he cried is because he understood he'd done terrible wrong. You see, he couldn't hang it on. He was an alcoholic. He couldn't want, oh, I'm just poor alcoholic. No, he was 17 years old and in the wrong place at the wrong time. We went in, there was a lot of reporters around, and the reporter said to him, Sherman, this has got to be the best day of your life. He said, oh, this is a good day. It's just one of the better days I've ever had in my life, but the best day of my life was when Reverend Ed came in and told me he loved me, and that God loved me and he forgave me. He said, that's the day I was free. And I realized that's my story, you see. I didn't know it then, but the day I came into Alcoholics Anonymous was the day I was granted my freedom from the bondage of self. And all you've ever asked me to do is give back what I've been given. And I need to tell you that's impossible because I've been given too much. But I will do my best a day at a time to somehow give you a little bit of what you've given me. I walk around in this world with my head up high because I know God loves me, and I know I love God, and I know I love each and every one of you. Now you might say, how can I say that? I don't know you. I don't need to. I know this, that if there's anything I could ever do in my life to help your life, I'd do it, and that's called love. I may not like a lot of behavior, but I love you. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women that can change your world. Question is, will you let it? One day at a time. Thank you.